This is WMUK 102.1 FM, Music NPR, Local Arts and More. Andrew Kohler is here. He's conductor, of course, of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra. Hello.
Hi, Kara.
The concert coming up is Sunday at 4 o'clock in the Chenery Auditorium, as usual. And there's two works on the program, Dvorak Symphony No. 8 and Cullen O'Neill, the KJSO Concerto Competition winner, will be featured in the first movement of the Elgar Concerto.
Cullen is an amazingly gifted young cellist. So, I mean, anyone who wins our concerto competition is already, I think by default, a pretty talented person. I think Cullen is a particularly special cellist. I hesitate to even use the phrase because it feels so cliched, but it's so apt with Cullen. She has an old soul. She's actually, it surprised me. Someone reminded me recently that she actually hasn't been playing the cello for all that long. Something only like 5 years, which for someone who is a sophomore in high school, she is now at that level of advancement, is somewhat shorter than usual, but you would never know it.
Is it hard to play it if you're a short, a small person growing up? It takes a while to actually...
Oh, of course. But, as with all string instruments, there are little eighth size and quarter size cellos, just like there are violins. So that it's just as common to start the cello at the age of 5, as my sister did, for example, as it is the violin. But Cullen, if I understand correctly, came to the cello a little bit later, but plays with such a profound musicianship, such thoughtfulness in interpretation, almost unlike any young musician that I know. I mean, she really just seems to love this music. And I think maybe that's another one of the rare things that she shares with a small group of special cohorts in the Junior Symphony, that when I see them perform, very often for young musicians, performance is, it is nerve-wracking for all of us, and one can feel sort of that when they're performing, they come to the stage with this great reluctance. They just need to, they've been working very hard on this and they want to show everybody, but they're really nervous and they'll just sort of get it done. Not so with Cullen and with a few of these others. They just radiate this joy about making music. She's also the sort of girl who comes to rehearsal. She did the other day with a shirt that had a picture of Shostakovich on it. And actually, she was just recently honored with something very exciting. The Carnegie Hall sponsored a National Youth Orchestra for America, which they've not done before. This is sort of a new project. And Cullen was accepted as a member of the orchestra, which is a tremendous honor. She's representing Kalamazoo in the National Youth Orchestra. And this National Youth Orchestra will do 2 weeks of intensive rehearsals at SUNY Purchase, I think, with Valery Gergiev as their conductor and Joshua Bell as their violin soloist in the Tchaikovsky Concerto. And I think the main work is the Shostakovich 10th Symphony. They'll perform in Carnegie Hall. I think they then subsequently perform in Moscow and St. Petersburg, which is especially exciting for Cullen because she's actually studying Russian right now. And then they actually play at the BBC Proms this year. So a really tremendous opportunity, and we're all so proud of Cullen.
That's terrific. The Elgar is the work that she's prepared. It is, to my mind, one of the great cello concertos of all time. And it would take a lot of soul to play.
I think that's just it. I mean, this again speaks to Cullen's particularly evolved sense of musicianship, because she won this concerto competition, a very competitive concerto competition, by the way, with some very fine musicians who tried out for it and some very fine people who ended up getting only honorable mentions. But what I think is significant is that she won it with the first movement of the Elgar Cello Concerto. And that first movement, as we'll soon hear, is very elegiac in tone and not at all what one expects from a concerto. It doesn't have the fireworks, it certainly has technical challenges, there's no question about that. But more than anything else, it's quite slow, quite reflective, and much more about the sort of soul of its music making than it is just simply about showing off the pyrotechnics of a great technique. And that could have captured the attention of the judges beyond some flashier works, I think, again, speaks highly of Cullen's musicianship. ¶¶
We're back. That was the first movement of the Elgar Cello Concerto. If you've just tuned in during the music, my guest is Andrew Kohler, who will be conducting the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra this Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. And the program includes a special performance by the KJSO Concerto Competition winner, Cullen O'Neill. She's a cellist, and she's going to be playing this beautiful movement from the Elgar Concerto.
It is really a fantastic, incredibly moving work, all the more moving, I think, when one realizes that Elgar lived for many years after this concerto was written, which was shortly after World War I, but never really composed another substantial work after this. This was really his final significant statement.
Really?
And he, one of the things that this, of course, is a program called Homeland, and Homeland has a lot to do with the Dvorak Eighth Symphony, as we'll soon discuss, because that is very much a nationalistic piece of music that celebrates the Czech people in Bohemia. But here, too, there's a real sense of homeland, but in a very different kind of way. In a lot of ways, this piece has been seen as a kind of mourning for the England that Elgar knew before World War I. And he's obviously writing this in the wake of World War I, realizing, in a sense, that kind of truism that you can't go home again. You know, that the Britain, the empire that he knew, that he grew up in, was simply not going to be the same after the horrors of that war that really shook the continent. I teach a music history class that touches on that time period, and it's really quite amazing what a profound shift World War I created in the music of the continent and in Great Britain. And in a lot of ways, Ray Vaughan Williams, all that English folk song collecting, that's a late kind of burgeoning nationalism, but also an attempt to try and recreate what Elgar already saw as gone, right? That the pastoral English countryside destroyed both by industrialization and certainly by World War I. So that's why the tone of this concerto is so deeply introspective, so deeply nostalgic. Even the middle theme of that movement we just heard sounds almost dance-like, but it's sort of a ghost of a dance. It's not quite all the way there. There's always this melancholy that tinges every note of it.
Melancholy is something that young people can also relate to and play with. With their heart,
I think so. And Cullen, as I say, has a particularly advanced and sort of mature musicianship. And I know she thought very hard about this piece, and because she's thinking so hard about it, her views on it keep changing subtly a little bit, you know, from week to week. So that actually makes it very exciting for me, because we'll sort of see what the end product this weekend will be. But either way, I know it'll be great.
Let's move on to the Dvorak Eighth Symphony, which, by order, comes before the Ninth, which I know came from the New World. He was here writing that. Is the Eighth Symphony from before his trip to the United States?
It is. It's shortly before his trip to the United States, and it you know. The three most famous symphonies, I would say, by Dvorak are the Seventh and the Eighth and the Ninth, and each one of those is a little more famous than the last, perhaps. And those really kind of encapsulate in a microcosmic sort of way Dvorak's late career. The Seventh Symphony, which actually the KSO did very recently, such a wonderful work, incredible. And it's really an homage to Brahms. So Dvorak, was the son of a butcher. His father was not really keen on the idea of him becoming a musician, didn't really see a lot of hope for this, but he did, and he sort of made some successes, of course, early on in his career. But the thing that really started to change for him was the patronage, the discovery of Johannes Brahms, who recommended Dvorak to his publisher, who really liked his Slavonic dances, and all those things started to put Dvorak on a much broader career path, one where he was starting to win recognition in Europe. So the Seventh Symphony is very much an homage to Brahms. It has this darkness to it, this incredibly thorough working out of contrapuntal lines, all these things very much kind of thank you, sort of honoring of Brahms's musical technique.
Brahms wasn't one to recommend just anybody.
Oh,
either.
Absolutely not. No, he was definitely the curmudgeon of Vienna. I mean, if he liked you, you knew that you'd done something really right, you know, to catch his eye. He was actually, I think, a very kind man from everything I've read, but certainly not quite stingy with his praise, we'll put it that way. Also, the Seventh Symphony came at a time when his mother had recently died, and I think that affected him a lot and maybe added to some of the darkness of that piece. But the Eighth Symphony, sort of the next step in that evolution, in Dvorak's evolution, that is to say, by this point, he's really pretty firmly recognized as a great composer in Europe, and he's very comfortable being able to write this music, which has made him famous. In other words, music that sort of uses the rhythms and some of the melodic sensibilities of Czech folk music and inject that into a very rigorous, thorough, basically Germanic kind of symphonic composition. So he's able to meld the two, you know, and that's really what the spirit of nationalism was. Of course, his notion of home is very different than Elgar's notion of home, writing a few decades later. Elgar is writing from the vantage point of someone who has known empire, has been the dominating power, and perhaps sees that at its end. Whereas Dvorak, in the late 19th century, is writing as someone who does not have a sovereign nation to call his own. He's really under the yoke of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at that time, and is trying to find a voice for the Czech people within that very brightly colored tapestry that was the Austrian Empire.
I don't understand Bohemia. Where, what, when?
it basically lines up with the modern day Czech Republic. Yeah. So there's two major parts, two major sort of ethnic subdivisions of the current day Czech Republic: the Bohemians and the Moravians. And they're different than the Slovakians. Obviously, Czechoslovakia was for a long time sort of pushed together as one country, and now they've separated into two separate entities. So Janáček, another great Czech composer, was of, if I'm not mistaken, of Moravian descent, and Dvořák and Smetana were both Bohemian, which is where Prague lies.
Thank you.
certainly. And so the Eighth Symphony was, of course, him really in a celebratory mode, I think, in a lot of ways. He had arrived, so to speak. He knew that he finally had a comfortable career. He was not just making it, but actually really quite successful. And the Eighth Symphony is the happy result. And then later, of course, because he was so successful, particularly crafting this sort of Czech nationalistic identity, he was asked to come to America and teach us to do very much the same thing. So that accounts for the Ninth Symphony from the New World, which was written after he was invited by, I believe her name was Jeanette Thurber, who was the director of a New York conservatory, and who felt very much that America lacked its own sort of distinctive musical voice, and invited Dvorak to sort of teach them how they might do it. And his suggestion was to rely on black spirituals and on American Indian music. He felt that within those two categories, there was all the folk music America would ever need to be able to do very much what he had done. In other words, take sort of rigorous symphonic forms of classical music and sort of imbue them with this folk-like sensibility in their melodies.
Was he a collector? Did he go around towns and write down traditional tunes?
That's a great question. He was not in the... I suppose somewhat in the 19th century sense, right? But what I mean by that is that ethnomusicology took on a much more sort of, and this is a very fraught word, but authentic approach in the 20th century. When time was really starting to run out, people like Bartok, he was really one of the first, and Kodály were one of the first to go out with actual cylinders and record people in villages. To the best of my knowledge, well, first of all, that technology didn't exist, but to the best of my knowledge, Dvorak's encounter with Czech music or even with spirituals were through meeting a few people, but not through sort of extensive field research where he was really out traveling those lands and trying to hear all the folk songs he could. So I think he was quite content, and this is very true in most of his symphonies, and in the Ninth and Eighth as well, that he wasn't necessarily trying to quote folk music so much as he was just trying to write something that evoked its spirit.
So the melodies are all his own.
That's right. That's right. In fact, the famous slow movement of the Ninth Symphony was turned into a spiritual after he wrote it. It was original tune, and it just sounded so convincingly like a spiritual that words were put to it. And many people figure, reasonably enough, that it might have been the other way around. But in fact, it was Dvorak's original tune. But we're in this center section, the Eighth Symphony. And this is Dvorak with a stable family life, finally. I mean, I had spoken about how his mother had passed away shortly before the Seventh Symphony, and in good spirits and very much in charge of his compositional craft and feeling like he is one of the great successful composers of Europe, and channeling very much the Czech and more broadly Slavic spirits. So surely enough, a wonderful piece in G major has to begin in the minor. There's always something a little bit sad about the Slavic soul. There's actually, my parents are Ukrainian, and there's an expression in Ukrainian which I think sums up the psyche to a certain degree, which is, don't laugh too much because you'll be crying soon. I would not say that this characterizes this piece very much, but I mean it only to point out that there's always just a little tinge of sadness, even in the happiness. And sure enough, it starts out with this brooding but gorgeous theme in the cellos. So Cullen has lots to do on this concert. She'll be veering from one end to the other. But then soon enough, it's sort of like the fog of this initial statement clears away by the principal flute, who sounds very bird-like and sort of invites people to start this much more energetic theme. There's a second theme that's really playful, I think. It's almost sort of mock serious, you know. It's in the clarinets and flutes, and there are these wonderful accompanimental figures in the strings that keep they keep crescendoing and decrescendoing. They sound a little bit like someone stretching out their hand and then taking it away at the last minute, you know? And that initial theme that the cello started with, that Dvorak added on to the piece, by the way, this is a testament to his melodic invention. It's not even the first, you know, in most symphonic first movements are two themes. This isn't even the first real theme. It's just an extra bonus theme that he puts in there. And he uses it as a transitional piece. He comes back to it again to start the development, the major middle section. And then at the end of the development, he uses it as a climactic way. It's restated now in trumpets and very defiantly to ease back in to the recapitulation.
We're listening to the Vienna Philharmonic with Herbert von Karajan conducting the first symphony, or the first movement of the Symphony No. 8 by Antonín Dvořák. And it's great music. Here to talk about it is Andrew Kohler, who will be directing his own performance with the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra live Sunday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Chenery Auditorium. And I haven't said this until this point, but more information is available online at kjso.org or kalamazoojuniorsymphony.org. It's all there. That's an invigorating symphony, I must say.
It's, you know, I've often thought that one of the marks of a truly great composer is someone who can write fundamentally happy music and make it seem really great, really serious, really profound. I think it's often easier, particularly in the romantic aesthetic, to write something that's sort of dark and dreary and perhaps even self-loathing sometimes, you know, and those are the sorts of things that can have an immediate appeal for an audience and for a composer, and to give a work a sense of weight. But if you can write something that is just sort of truly unbridled and joyful, you know, and make that a great piece of music, not make it seem slight. I really think that's the mark of a great composer. Of course, Brahms achieved it in the Second Symphony. Beethoven did it in the Pastoral, and Dvorak does it here. And it's one of the things I have sort of limitless love for this piece of music. I mean, it really makes me happy to hear or to conduct this music.
You're reminding me of a very similar discussion I had when Raymond Harvey was here to talk about the Symphony No. 7. And I said, Dvorak doesn't wallow very much in those sad, dark things. And I kind of like composers that wallow and get into it. And he agreed that, you know, Dvorak doesn't just... He's happy to go light and dark and light and dark rather than just dark.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is one of those pieces that is almost entirely light. And yet every note of it is a masterpiece. It's just perfect. And it's so sunny and wonderful. Invigorating was a great word, I think, for that first movement, that there's so much wonderful energy. And Dvorak is at this point in his compositional trajectory, such a master of pacing. I think we might take a listen to this last movement as we close out the interview. And the last movement is another great example, because it starts with a very energetic fanfare, sort of relaxes for a little bit, and there's a much more welcoming, genteel sort of tune in the cellos for a little while that builds up, and then all of a sudden the whole orchestra comes crashing in with this great exciting thing that even includes these wonderful sort of huzzas in the form of horn trills. So much fun. And then after this develops for a little while, there's sort of a rustic country peasant dance in the middle of it that sounds a little bit out of tune because of the way he's placed these sort of passing dissonances. All of that calms down, and we sort of return to that more genteel opening, but it's even more introverted. And he really sort of slows down the pace of this finale for a little while, and does it so expertly, because just as you're starting to feel really calmed by the events, that opening sort of huzzah thing comes back and sort of whips up a frenzy into a headlong rush to the very final notes of the symphony. I should hasten to say also that, though we won't have time to listen to him today, the second and third movements are also so wonderful. The second movement is such a beautiful moment of repose, and but has such intense drama in the middle of it as well. I think it's in many ways is the least perhaps overtly tuneful of Dvorak's movements. It's much more modeled in the sort of Beethovenian motivic kind of way. But in contrast, the third movement, which is really two juxtaposed waltzes, that is Dvorak at his most tuneful. That's the one I think everyone will leave humming afterwards. It's such a wonderful tune.
As far as the members of the orchestra, the sections of the orchestra, do they all have a chance to play melody throughout this symphony?
I think just about
everyone. Well distributed.
Yes, just about. I mean, it is truly a great work also in the sense that, you know, every once in a while there are works that are perhaps really wonderful, but they're better to hear than they are to perform. They're a little bit less fun to perform than they are to hear. Or there are other pieces that are the reverse of that. And there are certain pieces that are just not, don't have great parts for everyone. I feel this is one of those works that satisfies on all criteria. You know, it is intensely rewarding to play in just about every corner of the orchestra, and just as rewarding to hear as well.
Does it take more concentration for the orchestra to perform a long form symphony like this in four movements, or do you reset between movements and treat each one like its own piece?
There's a little bit of that, but I would say mostly, especially in this era of composition, that we tend to think and tend to approach the symphony as one sort of holistic work, even though these are definitely distinct movements. Because of that, I would say that often there is a real challenge in taking on something like a symphony as opposed to, say, a suite or just a series of smaller one-movement works. I think there is a certain rigor, the same rigor that Dvorak applied in the compositional process. You know, I mean, it wasn't just sort of a collection of folk tunes like the Slavonic dances are. In other words, I think it might be easier in some ways to do a set of Slavonic dances than it is to do a symphony, because there is a thoroughness, a rigor to the logic that follows through the entire symphony that also puts demands on the performer as well.
Well, he asked himself to do that in a symphonic form.
So, exactly right. Yes, and we should do no less.
What's next for the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony and you?
Thank you for asking. The Junior Symphony is really about to embark on an incredibly exciting year. We're going to be celebrating our 75th anniversary. We're one of the oldest youth orchestras in the country. So it's obviously a very important jubilee for us. And we've got really exciting things up ahead. We'll be joined by a Stolberg bronze medalist, as we always are, and we're delighted to continue that tradition. But in addition, we're also going to have the great pianist Alan Goldstein is going to come and perform with us. He's performed Kalamazoo before, and he will perform again with us through the generosity of the Gilmore Festival, who will help us bring him here. And we're so grateful to the Gilmore for making that possible. And in addition, we got very lucky, and a grant that we wrote to invite Midori to town means that she will do a residency with us, perform a concert with us and with the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra. So we couldn't be more delighted to invite Alan and Midori to town. Those are some really great musicians. And if all goes well, it's still in the planning stages and still only a potential, but there looks to be some excitement for even an international tour next year. So we've got lots, lots on the docket, and I couldn't be more excited. It's a really thrilling time, I think, for the Junior Symphony.
That's very exciting, very exciting. And you can keep up with what's happening at the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony online. Check in at kjso.org or kalamazoojuniorsymphony.org, and I'm sure there will be updates for every exciting event and concert.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Andrew.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Kara.
Here's the final movement of the Eighth Symphony.